All right, let's get started. I hope many of you have started the MIPS practical. If you haven't already, now's the time. We have lab demonstrators in the labs and in the lab, 504 North Lab. And right now, the demonstrators are fairly lightly loaded, so go along, you can get plenty of time with them. As I said before, if you wait for days, you wait until a day or two before the deadline next week, then the lab demonstrators are going to be a lot more busy and there's going to be a lot less time to get help. So I really encourage you to start now, just for your own benefit too, just so you've got kind of time to work things out in case there are any issues. But also there'll be time, start now, there'll be time to ask questions of the demonstrators. All right, so today the agenda is we're going to finish off the last slide or two from last week, and then move on to talking about how we then glue together logic components to make a processor. All right, so we're talking about finite state machines and how you can use this synchronous sequential model of logic to build a state machine or implement a state machine. So over here we have an example state machine for some kind of drinks machine that takes in money. It's a kind of rather old-fashioned one, a rather cheap one, that you can get something for 30p, but that's fine for our purposes. The idea is that you put money into this machine. You can put in 10p coins or 20p coins, and if you put in 30p, then it will sell you something. So we have a state machine for the size of this machine here. We start in a state S0, so this is when there's kind of 0p in the machine. We have these two inputs. This is a coin reader with two outputs, A and B, and these are then inputs to the state machine. So each of these transitions is labeled by a pair of numbers. And this pair of numbers corresponds to what the coin reader is saying has just been inserted into the machine. So for example, if we have an arc with 1, 0, this means a 10p coin has just been inserted, whereas a 0, 1 means a 20p coin has been inserted. So for example, we're here with no money in the machine, somebody inserts a 10p coin, and we go to state S1. And so I've written 10p over here to kind of remind you that's what S1's all about. It's about when it's kind of recording that 10p has been entered to the machine. Perhaps you enter 10p again, and you take this transition down here. If, right, we've got an idea of this thing being a synchronous machine, so there's a kind of a heartbeat, there's a clock providing a heartbeat. So something's happening on every tick of a clock. We're making some transition based on the current input. And there's an idea, too, that when we provide an input in the form of coin, the input is there just for a single beat of this clock that's ticking away. So if we see two 10p's in succession, that means two distinct 10p's have been inserted into the machine, rather than just one kind of taking a long time to fall in. So here, you've inserted one 10p, you've got to here. If there's a while where you do nothing, we just circle around, stay in the state. If somebody inserts another 10p, we go to this 20p state down here. Of course, we could have got here directly as well by just putting in 20p to start off with. And now, say we're here, we insert 10p again, we take this arc here to this state here, or maybe we just overpay, we haven't got the right change, and we put another 20p in. That again takes us to this state here. So this state here is a state when 30p or more has been inserted into the machine. And then the idea is that once we're in this state, on the next beat of the clock, we make this transition back to state S0. And here, we're using some notation that's sometimes used with state machines to show an output generated by a state machine. Did you use this notation at all in previous years? Previous year? Good. Right. So here this is using the notation you've seen. It doesn't quite correspond to how things will be implemented, but we'll come to the slight differences in a second. So the idea is you reach here, and then on the next clock tick, no matter what the inputs are, that's shown by two X's, we make a transition back here, and we output a 1. And the idea is the state machine outputting a 1 then makes the machine actually deliver whatever it is that you're buying for 30p. So here's an example state machine. Let's see in the next slide then how you would realize this using synchronous sequential logic. So what we do is we have this archetypal design with a register here holding the current state of the machine, and then some combination logic here, which takes the current state and takes the inputs, and it computes an output, and it computes some signals here, which is the state we're going to go to on the next clock tick. If we can design logic for the state machine, first of all, we count up the number of states. We say there are 4 states, and to represent 4 states, we just need 2 bits. So that's why here we've got a 2-bit register. Now to design a combination of logic, we just start drawing out a truth table. So we say, and we have down here, not an exhaustive one, it's going to be an exhaustive enumeration eventually of all the possible inputs to the combination of logic. So the current state here, and then the options you got on the signals, input signals A and B. And notice, for example, we've dropped the state, the possibility that both A and B will be equal to 1. we're just assuming that that never occurs, that, that nobody can insert into the machine a 10p and a 20p simultaneously. And then what we do is we just consider each of these cases, and then we say, well, given this case, this is what now what the next state should be. So we've got the next state in these two bits, and here's an output that should be generated. So for example, here we've got this line here is for us in state zero, somebody inserting a 10p, which is making the B input go high. And in that case, we transition to a state with S1 equal to 1 and S0 equal to 0. So if we kind of come back to the previous, actually that is, so if B is 1, that's a 0, 1 going in. So that's, sorry, 0, 1, that's a B high is going to be a 20p being inserted. So that's going to take us from here to state S2. And that's what's, this is the number 2 in binary here. And in this case, we get a 0 output. So you can go through a similar exercise for every combination of inputs and figure out for that current state and a combination of inputs what your next state should be and what your output should be. So hopefully you kind of get the idea here. You can take a, there's a recipe here for taking a state machine and realizing it as a synchronous state machine, like we've seen just now and like we've seen presented last week. We're now going to, that's all I wanted to do to, that's the kind of, I think that's the last slide. Yeah, for, go away. I want to say, nope. Let's get rid of that. All right. So now we're going to kind of take that basic idea and see it implemented in a very rich setting to see how you can build a processor as a finite state machine. Actually, it's a finite state machine, but very, very large finite state. All right. So let's get this full screen. All right, so we're going to look at how to design a processor. So if you remember right back in the very first lecture, I threw up this picture here, top right corner, that you also saw, that you'll find in versions of the Patterson and Hennessy book. This is kind of showing the fundamental components of any processor. The processor has actually a computer rather than a single processor. A computer's got some memory for holding data. It's got a data path which goes through a processor where data gets manipulated somehow. There's an idea of control also being read from the memory, which actually says what the manipulation is going to be of the data on the data path. And there's the idea of data coming in somehow and getting stored in memory, and then data flowing out somehow. So in this model of processor, very crudely, if we're focusing on this processor part, then the two crucial parts are the data path, so the way in which data flows from memory into the processor, gets worked on, and then flows back to memory, and then control, so the way in which what we actually do to the data and where we take it from. And we'll see now how to use the ideas from the last lecture to realize this. For this MIPS processor that we've also seen. All right, so we're going to go through a kind of toy exercise. We're going to kind of put on our CPU design caps and kind of think about, well, how would we go about designing a processor? So try to kind of motivate what's there. So we're going to, first of all, figure out what building blocks we want, and then we're going to start looking at how we put those building blocks together. All right. So what we're going to do is, on the left-hand side here, look at things that we want to do on the right-hand side, we'll start writing down a list of the logical blocks that we want to use to achieve that. So firstly, we want to fetch instructions from memory. Now, if we want to fetch an instruction, we have to know where that instruction is. So we need a register to hold a value for the current instruction. We call this register the program counter, or the PC. So we need a register to hold the current address to fetch an instruction from. We also, of course, need a memory which can hold those instructions. And an adder would be useful. So there's this idea of instructions being laid out sequentially in memory, and then after we've fetched one instruction, by default, what we want to do is go and fetch the next instruction, which is stored at the next word. And if you remember, every word is 4 bytes. So what we want to do after fetching one instruction is add 4 to the program counter, so that then the program counter is pointing at the next byte, next instruction. Then too, say we've got some data in our registers, we want to do something with that data. So we want to be able to take data out of registers. Well, if we want to take data out of registers, well, we need some registers in the first place. So we build what's called a register file. So a register file is nothing more than a collection of registers. In this case, we want 32, if we're doing MIPS, we want 32-bit registers within our CPU to hold the data that is currently going to be worked on. Now, we need a rather special kind of memory where we can do several operations on that data at once. In general, if you look through the different classes of instructions in MIPS, you'll find that very often we want to be able to pull out 2 pieces of data at once from the register file. Say we're doing an addition operation. We've got to pull out the 2 arguments for the addition. If doing even something like a load word, which that's not a good example, even say store word, we've got one register involved in the calculation of an address, another register involved in the data that's eventually going to be pushed out to memory. So we need 2 ways. We need a register memory or register file, which we can pull simultaneously 2 register contents out of, and also perhaps do a single write back to it. So if we're doing an add instruction, we need to be able to, after doing the addition itself, we need to put that result back into the memory. If we're doing a load word, we need to put the result of that load into the register file somewhere. All right, so we need processor task. We need to be able to execute. We need to be able to do operations like shifts and ands and logical operations. So what we need for that, okay, so here's, we need, we have data processing instructions like the ones I talked about. For those we use, we construct a unit very often called an ALU, so an arithmetic logic unit. So this is a kind of glob of combinational logic that does lots of arithmetic and logical things for you, like adds and subtracts and shifts and multiplies and that kind of thing. We also want to be able to fetch data from memory and write it out again. So we need a memory to hold that data. Now, we talked right at the beginning in the first lecture about different architectures for CPUs that basically you could either have a separate memory for instructions, have one memory for instructions and one memory for data, or what we can have is have just a single memory for both, and then each program kind of decides where its data is going to reside and its program is going to be stored. For simplicity right now, we're going to assume that instructions are held in a separate memory from data. It just makes the kind of flow of argument in this lecture easier. So we're going to need in our component list both a memory for instructions and a memory for data here. Then we also want to implement branch instructions. And when we do branches, what comes with a branch instruction often is a number which has to be added to the current program counter to figure out where we've got to jump to. And perhaps we can do this addition using the ALU. perhaps what we should do is have a separate hardware component for doing that addition. This, what we have here is an example of a kind of much more general question that hardware designers often face when designing hardware, that they've got a given budget in terms of components, and they've got to figure out how to achieve those operations given those components. And sometimes they'll want to, as an architect, one will want to kind of reuse components a lot. Other times there'll be kind of, multiple operations that we want to do at once. So you want to use the ALU to do some addition, and we also want to do addition in the addition to, say, computing some branch address that we're going to branch to. So maybe it actually makes sense to have two separate components so we can do those two operations at the same time. All right, so we've got an idea of the things that we might, the components that we might draw on to build a simple CPU. So how are we going to kind of continue this discussion, how are we going to come up with a design? With a RISC processor or with RISC-style architectures, one thing that's been done is to try to keep the instruction set as modular and as simple as possible in order to simplify the logic which actually implements the processor. This allows us to make our design smaller and therefore faster often. Another design principle sometimes that's useful is this one in the third bullet here. Be optimistic. You can sometimes do operations if you might need the result, but sometimes even if you might not, it actually might be simpler to design logic to say always do some addition of, always have the ALU do something, even if on some cycles we actually don't even need that ALU. It may be easier to allow it to do something rather than to explicitly try to switch it off or inhibit it from doing something. All right, so here on this slide is a rather fuzzy first kind of sketch of how we might connect together some of the components that we saw a couple slides ago. What we've got here are several components, the instruction memory here, a data memory here, this is the ALU, and here's the register for our program counter. And here in the middle we've got a bank of our register file. And the basic idea here is, so our program counter contains the address of our current instruction. The program counter feeds the address into the instruction memory. The instruction memory delivers, it has a whole sequence of locations, and it delivers as output the instruction stored at the location indicated by the input address. So that's what the instruction memory does. Given we've got an instruction now, you've seen in these lectures on MIPS how the instruction field then is divided up into components. And we extract out different fields and use them for different purposes. So, for example, if we're doing a branch instruction, let's look at this logic briefly at the top here. Here we've got a simple adder that just adds 4 to the current program counter and feeds it back to the program counter. So this is the adder used for just incrementing the program counter onto the next instruction. What we've got here is an adder that would be used for branch instructions. So with branch instructions, what you do is you take some information from the bottom 16 bits of the branch instruction, and you add that to the current value of the program counter, actually more precisely, the current value of the program counter plus 4, and use that as the new address that you're going to load into the program counter on the next clock cycle. So that's the logic up here. Many things that you do involve registers. So for example, if this instruction is an add instruction, then you might have 2 inputs to the register file for registers that should be read from. So these 2 addresses going into the register file might govern outputs here and here the same add instruction or subtract instruction that the ALU should perform. If it's just something like an add or subtract, we have a data path coming from the ALU back into a data input to the register file. And we might have this final register address here indicate where that data should be written back to. Sometimes, as well as doing these operations just on data and registers, we might be doing data transfers between registers and memory. Here, so now, let's see how that might work. If we're doing a load from memory, we might use the ALU here to do an address calculation. If you remember, chalk thief here. Let's see if this thing will do anything. So sorry for a sec, I've just forgotten what I was going to. Could somebody remind me what I was? The chalk just distracted me so much. What was I just going to show you? Sorry? Oh, right, I'm going to do transfers between. So I was going to remind you about addressing modes, of course. So we're going to do load word. You say you have a register where the data is going to go to, and then you've got this basic information about the address here. So S is the name of it, is a 5-bit number telling you a register that you're going to fetch an address from. And N here is a 16-bit offset, which you're going to add to that register contents in order to calculate the address that you're going to fetch the data from. So that's why we need an LU here. So the LU is going to take the value N from the instruction and take it here, and then over here we'll have data coming out of the register file for the value X. That'll compute an address, and then the data coming out of the memory will come back here and get stored according to, say, one of these other inputs to the register file. For store, we're again going to do some kind of address calculation, but we'll be pulling data out of another port, another output of the register file, and sending it down this wire here and writing it to data memory. So I hope from that discussion you kind of got some idea that this is a plausible architecture for a CPU that's going to execute these kinds of MIPS instructions that we've seen recently. Are there any questions on this? All right, let's keep going. All right, so now we're going to flesh out that architecture a bit more. There's a lot more in this slide than the previous slide, so a fair amount to explain. The first thing that's going to get this thing key is at the top in the title. What we're after is a single cycle implementation. So what we're going to try to design here is a CPU which executes one instruction per cycle. So let's see then what's going to happen. So what we've got, what have we got? We've got our adders at the top here look pretty much like before. We've thrown in an explicit multiplexer here, which allows us, say, to select whether the new address going back to the PC comes from the just this add four operation here, or also includes some addition of the branch offset from the branch instruction. So the idea is that it's not shown here, but in various places in this cyan color, what we've got are control inputs to different pieces of logic. And we're going to eventually generate these control signals from looking at various parts of the instruction coming out of the instruction memory here. But we're not showing that logic yet. All right, so the logic at the top is like it was on the previous slide. We have our instruction memory here, fed by addresses from the program counter, pretty much the same as before. We're being here a bit more explicit about these inputs to our register file. We've got two addresses that we're going to read from, and when we read from this address, the output appears here. When we read from this address, the output appears here. And then we've got an address which we can write to, and we've got the write data coming in. So that's here for the register file. Now, this is a single cycle design. So the idea not shown here, but implicit, is there's a clock signal which over time is going high and low. And the idea is, say, on the beginning of an instruction execution will happen on a rising edge of clock. So on some rising edge of clock, some new address will be loaded into the program counter, and that will initiate a fetch of data from the program counter, a decode of that instruction, and then all the things that instruction implies. And then what will happen will be, at the very end of the cycle, we will have computed kind of the next, what are the kind of next state values for the state machine? We will have computed any new values to be written into the program counter, any new values to be written into the register file here, and any new data to be written into the data memory here. So that's our objective in a cycle. We're going to assume, for simplicity, so this is an ideal, rather naive design. And I want to walk you through this one first, because we will talk about a design of CPU in which it takes multiple instructions to execute, multiple cycles to execute instruction next lecture. And then we'll even look at what's called a pipeline design after that, where an instruction may take several cycles, and in fact the CPU will be executing multiple instructions at different stages simultaneously. But that's all kind of extra complexity. And let me simplify. What I'm doing here is just simplifying, giving you the ideas about the data flow and control in a kind of simpler setting so you get these ideas down first. All right, so we've got this idea of things being started on one clock cycle, or on an edge of a clock cycle, and then kind of final data being latched, being stored at the end of the clock cycle, ready for things to happen again on the next clock cycle for the next instruction. All right, so we looked at the register file in a bit more detail. Here again, we've got a multiplexer which now explicitly selects whether this input to the ALU comes from the register file or comes from over here. So this is when we're doing these address calculations. Like these addresses here, that we take the 16-bit field from the instruction, we do a sign extend on it, and then we feed that, if we're doing one of these calculations, we then feed that into the ALU here. And here we've got a control signal, ALU source, which is controlling this multiplexer here. So we saw kind of a 1-bit multiplexer last week. Hopefully it's easy to imagine how you can make how you can just put those units in parallel to make a multiplexer for a whole bus of 32 bits. So many of these, most of these signals here are 32-bit wide. Sometimes we put these diagonal lines and numbers along these lines to indicate the number of actual binary signals along that signal path or bus. So here, 16 here indicates we're taking 16 bits here, and we're creating a 32-bit sign-extended result. We've got an ALU here. It's got a couple of outputs, the normal output for the arithmetic operation, and also a bit which just says whether the ALU result is zero or not. We'll see later why that's useful. The ALU itself has got some inputs up here, which allow us to specify what the ALU is going to do. Is it going to do an add, or a shift, or a subtract, or some logical operation, but whatever. Our data memory here, it's now explicitly got an address here, write data, and then the read data output. And then again, we've got a multiplexer explicit here, which selects, which is controlling the data which has been written to the register file, allowing us to select, based on this control signal here, whether we're selecting the read data from the data memory, or we're selecting the ALU output to go back into the register file. So given what we saw before and my talking through that, I hope the extra detail here now is fairly straightforward. Any questions about this slide? Good? Let's keep going. All right, now I'm going to look at the control logic. So we've got to design some logic which is going to generate all those cyan, all those blue control signals that we saw based on looking at parts of the instruction here. So parts of this, so we've got 32 bits coming out here. We're peeling off a few bits for these addresses here and for this here. But sometimes, too, we look at some of these bits to govern what these various cyan blue control signals are going to do. And so it's a logic design task, a bit like designing that finite state machine before, that we consider each instruction, and those are then the input signals to our control logic, and we say for that instruction, we need to set this control signal high, this one low, this one high, and so on. Now, that's the kind of the recipe for the first three bullets. There's a mark here about sometimes if you're figuring out what operation the ALU should do, you might do it in two stages rather than one. That you might kind of figure out the general class of operation that the ALU might have to do. Like, is it doing an operation where it's reading two registers and then writing one register? Or is it doing something else, say, helping to compute an address, like here? And then once you've figured that out, you might kind of go down to a deeper level and say, well, if it is doing a straight register-to-register operation, what is the operation that should be done? And if you look in at the MIPS instruction set, you actually see this happen. There's a lovely table on one page of the textbook, which shows how instructions are decoded, and kind of shows you this two-stage decoding of the ALU operation. Here's a slide which talks just briefly about the ALU itself, the idea that these input bits to the ALU govern what operation is going to do. That here, in MIPS, we might have a 6-bit input. Here, we're just looking at a kind of idealized 4-input ALU, and we might have code 0 for the ALU makes it do an AND, code 1 makes it do an OR, code 2 makes it do an ADD, here subtract. Here, a set on less than, the idea that we're comparing two inputs and we're generating a 1 if 1 is less than, if input A is, say, less than input B, otherwise we're generating a 0. So that's different from a subtraction. And this is just saying in words what I say on the slide, what I said just previously. All right, so here we're revisiting again some control signals. Here we're being this is an embellishment of the previous slide, in that now we're starting to see a bit more detail about which bits of the instruction are going where. So we're seeing, we've got here this 31:0 is indicating that we've got 32 bits of instruction coming out here. And now here, what we're doing is we're selecting various subwords of that 32-bit word. So here, for example, we're selecting a subword from bits 25 down to bits 21. So if you remember, we start with the most significant bit being bit 31, least significant being bit 0, and so that's why we write the higher number first and the lower number second when we're talking about these ranges of bits. So here we're peeling off various address fields from the instruction. Here, for example, we're peeling off the bottom 16 bits, which we often use as an immediate value. And otherwise, this is fairly similar to the previous diagram that we've got. Perhaps a little bit more here, for example, what we're showing is actually some logic, which is perhaps doing the final selection of what operation the ALU is going to do based on information coming from the instruction, the bottom six bits, and also a control signal called ALUOP, which will be generated by the control logic that we'll see designed for this very shortly. What else have we got? We've got one or two more control signals I'll remark on. I'm not sure if they were shown before. We've got these write signals here and here for our register file and for our data memory. The idea is that, obviously, on every cycle, we're not necessarily wanting to do a write of the data that's presented to the inputs of this file or this memory. And so we only do a write when a write signal is asserted or made a logic 1. Yes? Oh, this is because the address, the part of the instruction that we pull the write address from varies sometimes between different instructions. So for some instructions, we pull the write address from bits 20 to 16 of the instruction. For other instructions, we pull the write address from bits 15 through 11. And so the idea is, again, there'll be some control logic not yet shown, which will generate this control signal here to select where the address is drawn from. All right. Here's the master slide now, which is kind of showing the control logic drawn in now. So here, what's happening is this control logic is looking at the top six bits of the 32-bit instruction coming out of the instruction memory. And then based on just those six bits, it's generating all these signals which then control these various components of our data path. And down here we've got an example of how we might build a truth table for all those different control signals. For example, so let's just take this first row here. So this is for an R format instruction. So R format instructions are these ones which work on, they take two arguments from the register file, they do something to those arguments in the ALU, and then they write the result back to the register file. So with an R format instruction, so now here we've got one column for each of the different control signals up above. So, for example, here's the, so this control signal here, destination register, is the one that controls this mux here. And for a register operation, an R format instruction, you want to set that to a logic 1, which then selects the write address from bits 15 through 11. So here, the point is that we need to extract three distinct register addresses from the instruction. So we use these three distinct 5-bit fields selected from the instruction with those three addresses going into the register file. We can work down this, so say for ALU source, that's set to 0. So what's ALU source? So we look up here, you see ALU source is controlling this MUX here. It's controlling whether the second input, the ALU, comes from the register file or comes from part of the instruction. So here, ALU source is set to 0 to make sure that this second input of the ALU comes from the register file. So now we know that data, we're kind of seeing that these control signals are kind of wiring up the data path in the right way for executing that particular instruction. We see a register write signal set to 1, so that's this signal here, because we know that at the end of the cycle, the end of executing this instruction, we're going to be able to write the data from the ALU back to the register file. And we could keep on going. I hope you've got the idea now for how this is working, and I encourage you to, in your own time, just walk through this table, convincing yourself that the other entries in the table all make sense. But are there kind of questions about what I was doing here? I mean, how the control logic now is working? Any immediate questions? Yeah?
What does the X mean?
The X means we don't care. So sometimes, say we're doing store word instruction, we don't care whether this control signal is set to a 0 or set to a 1. And by explicitly saying we don't care, rather than just randomly picking a 0 or a 1, what we do is we give the designer of the control logic flexibility for optimization. It may be that when they're designing that logic, or when a computer program is designing that logic, that more often is what happens with logic design these days, it's able to look at these X's and then come up with a smaller circuit and a faster circuit than would happen if you'd explicitly put in a 0 or a 1. Any other question? All right, let's keep going. On these final three slides, what I've got are walkthroughs of data flows for different instruction kinds. So we're kind of seeing again what I was putting in words, but kind of shown again on this kind of final master diagram. So here we've got R-type instructions. So these are the instructions which pull two values from the register file, do some operation on them in the ALU, and then write some value back to the register file. So what we're doing is, an instruction which isn't branching. So after this instruction executes, then we're fetching the next instruction. So what we see for start is, so what we have here is we have in red, in kind of bold red, we have the data flow paths that are enabled. And in green, we're showing the control signals that are asserted. So, there should be more. We're showing the main ones that are asserted. Other ones are kind of controlling these MUXes as well. Those signals are not being shown. What do we have then? So we have up here we have the add 4 for the program counter. That's coming over here through this MUX and back to the input to the program counter. So this program counter is just a register file. And so what we're saying is the next value of the program counter is the current value of the program counter plus 4. So this, the effect is at the end of the clock cycle, we'll load the program counter with the address of the next instruction. Then what we see is we're pulling these three addresses out of the instruction, the two read addresses and the write address for this operation that we're going to do. We see the data coming out of the register file here and here and going into the ALU. We see the output of the ALU bypassing the data memory, coming over here and coming round and being presented to the input to the register file. And we see the register write signal asserted. So here we've configured the control logic and the data path to achieve the execution of one of these R-type instructions. Here we see a different configuration of the data path for a load word instruction, a data transfer instruction between memory, from memory into the register file. So here we see we're only using, we see again that we're incrementing the program counter by 4 for this path at the top. Here we see we're just using 2 address fields from the instruction, the one for this register here and one for the register here. And one of them is used for reading, and this one here is used for writing. So the writing will be this one here. So we see, if we kind of follow what's going to follow things in sequence as they occur, we see that we take the data that we read from this register here into the ALU, and now we're taking data from the bottom 16 bits of the instruction, we're sun extending that data, and we're adding it to the output of the register. So we're doing this calculation, adding this immediate data here to the value in this register here. Once we've done that, we're using that as an address in the data memory, and we're taking the output of the data memory, feeding it through this multiplexer here, feeding it down here, around here, up here, and into the write data input of the register file. And we're also asserting the write signal to the register file to ensure that this write data gets written at the end of the clock cycle. So here's how we're realizing a load word instruction. And here finally is an example of how we realize a branch instruction. Different pattern again for what's happening to data. Let's look for start at, so here what we're doing is, so we're doing sort of a BEQ instruction. This is a branch if equal instruction. So this is comparing, the idea is this compares the values of 2 registers in the register file and sees if they're equal or not. If they are equal, then the branch is taken. If they're not equal, the branch is not taken. Let's see how that's realized in the flow of data here. So here we've got the addresses for the 2 registers that we're going to compare being peeled out of the instruction. The output there is fed to the ALU. The ALU is generating 0 output. That 0 output is controlling via this AND gate, this multiplexer here, which is choosing the next address for the program counter. And it's either choosing just the current value plus 4, we're not going to take the branch, or it's choosing the addition of the program counter plus 4 and this immediate value which has been pulled out of the instruction. All right, so that's shown you in this last 3 slides how the control logic configures the data path for realizing different classes of operations. This is the kind of essence of how we design a processor. We'll see next week it will be next week, so sorry, I should announce now, there won't be a lecture this Friday. The next lecture will be on Tuesday next week. So Tuesday next week we'll look at a more realistic design, slightly more realistic, where each instruction takes multiple cycles to execute. And then the lecture after that will look at how you get overlapping execution of instructions, so you don't have to wait for one to finish before you start on the following instruction. As I said at the beginning, please start in the lab now. You'll have Friday free of a lecture to continue in the lab. Good luck with it, and please make use of the demonstrators and make use of the discussion forum as well. So I've got at least one demonstrator watching the discussion forum every day, so you should be able to get help there as well, should you need it. Thanks very much.
Yes.